Welcome back to Chapter and Verse. This is episode 2 on our discussion about Acts chapter 15. Our goal with this program is to present for you biblically based material that is logical, reasonable, and mature. We hope this program will present the Bible in a way that is rational, grounded in Scripture, and easily applicable to your daily life. In this new series, we're discussing the topic of Acts chapter 15. What really happened? Through the centuries of Christian doctrine, there have been many interpretations of what exactly happened in Acts chapter 15. How should Gentile believers coming to a faith in a Jewish Messiah apply that faith to their lives? We ended episode 1 looking at Acts chapters 10 and 11 in depth in order to gain a proper contextual understanding about the circumstances that led to the conflict that is described in Acts chapter 15. Before we move on from chapters 10 and 11, however, there's one final point to make about the vision that Peter had. Peter shouldn't have been surprised at all by the vision. He shouldn't have been stunned when the Holy Spirit prompted him to let go of his ingrained Jewish perspective and embrace Gentiles and bring them into the faith. He'd already seen such behavior from Yeshua. When, you might ask? There's one passage in particular from the Gospels that illustrates this point. It's recorded for us in both Matthew and in Luke. And in both Gospel accounts, this event occurs directly on the heels of what we refer to as the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount is recorded in Matthew chapters 5 through 7 and in Luke chapter 6. The event I'm referring to takes place in Matthew chapter 8, verses 5 through 13, and in Luke chapter 7, verses 1 through 10. If we did a mashup of these two passages, it would read like this. After Yeshua had finished all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. When he had entered Capernaum, a centurion came forward to him, appealing to him. This centurion had a servant who was sick and at the point of death, who was highly valued by him. When the centurion heard about Yeshua, he sent to him elders of the Jews, asking him to come and heal his servant. These elders of the Jews came and gave the message to Yeshua, saying, "This man is worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation, and he is the one who built for us our synagogue." And Yeshua said to them, "I will come and heal him." And Yeshua went with them. When he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. Therefore, I did not presume to come to you, but say the word and let my servant be healed. For I too am a man set under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, 'Go,' and he goes, and to another, 'Come,' and he comes. And to my servant, 'Do this,' and he does it." When Yeshua heard this, he marveled and said to those who followed him, "Truly I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith. I tell you, many will come from the east and west and recline at the table with Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov in the kingdom of heaven, while the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness." And when those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the servant well. Now, there's a lot in this description to go over, so let's go over this point by point. Directly after Yeshua leaves the setting where he delivered the Sermon on the Mount, he goes to seek lodging in the nearby town of Capernaum. As he approaches Capernaum, he is approached by some men who have been sent by a Roman centurion. These men were identified as being elders of the Jews. So, by definition, these men must have been leaders in the synagogues in the Capernaum area. What is a centurion exactly? And what type of influence must this centurion have had over the city for the elders of the Jews to be sent on an errand for him as messengers? Well, first, let's define what a centurion is. most of us are familiar with the title and recognizing a centurion as some type of Roman soldier, but there's considerably more detail here that we should uncover about this position that this man held. This man wasn't simply a Roman soldier. That would have been a legionary. A legionary was the term for the common soldier. A centurion had typically around 80 legionaries under his command. So a centurion was a commander. Unlike legionaries, centurions had to be literate, which means that they had to be educated. They also had to be at least 30 years of age, and they had to have served in the military for several years before being promoted to centurion. According to a Roman author and historian, Vicetius, the centurion in the infantry is chosen for his size, strength, and dexterity in throwing missile weapons and for his skill in the use of his sword and shield. In short, for his expertness in all the exercises. He is to be vigilant, temperate, active, and readier to execute his orders he receives than to talk. Strict in exercising and keeping up proper discipline among his soldiers, in obliging them to appear clean and well-dressed and have their weapons constantly rubbed bright. So this man, having attained the status of centurion, was basically equivalent to our most elite special forces. He, as a commander, was one who had been educated. He displayed superior skills in weaponry as well as in battle, and he was capable of disciplining a group of 80 soldiers who looked to him for leadership. This means that this centurion was likely the highest ranking military official in the region where Capernaum was located. So this would have been a prestigious position with plenty of influence in the area. Could he have threatened the Jewish leaders through coercion and thus required them to run this errand for him in order to approach Yeshua with a message for him? Perhaps. But as we read, as the details unfolded, these men did not speak of the centurion as if he was forcing them to do anything. Instead, they described him as worthy and said that he loves our nation, and that it was this very centurion who had given the funds to build the synagogue that these Jewish leaders met in. So right off the bat, we have a very unique situation. There weren't many Roman soldiers who were trusted by the Jewish people, especially Roman soldiers who had influence and prestige. But this centurion was clearly an exception. What is further noteworthy is that the nature of his request was quite peculiar. It says that he had a servant who was sick and to the point of death, who was highly valued by him. Yet another remarkable situation. Why do I say that? Because in the Roman Empire, slaves were not seen as human. Slaves were considered property under Roman law, and they had no legal personhood. Most slaves would never be freed from their slavery at any point during their lifetime. Unlike Roman citizens, slaves were subject to capital punishment and could be killed without repercussion by their owners. Additionally, they could be subject to sexual exploitation or torture or any other number of things. Because of this fact, it's uniquely interesting that this centurion would even care enough about his servant to send a request to Yeshua for him to be healed. The mindset within the Roman Empire was that if your servant got sick and died, you just got a new one. Slaves were viewed as tools. They weren't viewed as being people. They were replaceable. That's what makes this situation so unique. Not only was this centurion a lover of Israel and highly respected among the Jewish leaders of the area, but he even went so far as to defy Roman custom and actually cared for one of his servants, and apparently even cared for him like a friend. This is what prompted him to seek out Yeshua's help. Yeshua, of course, would have known these things instantly based upon the description that was given to him by the Jewish leaders who delivered this centurion's message to him. This is why he offers to comply with the request. That's where we come to the most astonishing part of this story. Yeshua is not far from the house, it says, when the centurion sends more messengers to him. This would indicate that Yeshua was fully intending on entering this man's house, this Gentile's house. This would be a huge breach of Jewish protocol. As we discussed in the last episode, for Yeshua to enter this Gentile's home would be to expose himself to uncleanness. This will be a key factor as we take a look at Acts chapter 15. There's much more to say about what this second set of messengers said to Yeshua and how Yeshua responds to them, but we'll have to save that for another time. For now, let's continue to focus on how this relates to our topic at hand, Acts chapter 15. As I mentioned earlier in this episode, Peter receiving the vision that he did and being visited by the messengers sent from yet another centurion should not have been surprising at all. After all, he should have immediately recognized the situation, as he undoubtedly would have witnessed the centurion from Capernaum sending messengers to Yeshua. He also would have seen Yeshua's response and Yeshua's willingness to go to the centurion's house. Could this have been the very same centurion that we read about in Matthew chapter 8 and Luke chapter 7? Maybe, but we can't be sure. In the gospel accounts, the centurion is unnamed, and he resides in Capernaum. Capernaum is on the northwest side of the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee, as it's better known. In Acts chapter 10, the centurion that's there is named, and he's identified as being in Caesarea. Now, Caesarea was on the Mediterranean coast, north of current-day Tel Aviv, and south of current-day Haifa, as you will see on the map that's on the screen. This would have been just south of where Mount Carmel was located, the site of the events described in 1 Kings chapter 18, where the prophet Eliyahu challenges the priests of Baal to a duel to see whose God is greatest. So not only was this a completely different area, but the centurion in the Gospels was unnamed. These combined factors would seem to indicate that this centurion in Acts chapter 10 is a different centurion than the one that we read about earlier from the Gospels. If so, it reflects an even greater significance. Had the first centurion, the one we read about in the Gospels, shared his testimony with his peers? If so, had some of them come to faith in this Messiah that the disciples followed? We're told in Acts chapter 10, verses 1 through 3, some details about this second centurion that we didn't cover in our last episode. It says there that he was a devout man who feared Elohim with all his household, gave alms generously to the people, and prayed continually to Elohim. It also says that the reason he sent the messengers to Peter in the first place was due to a vision he had in which an angel appeared to him and gave him instructions to do just that very thing. He sent messengers from Caesarea, roughly 35 miles south to Jaffa, current-day Tel Aviv, essentially. This was about a full day's journey for these messengers. But the fact that this second centurion would have come to Peter should have triggered his memory about what he witnessed several years prior to that while in the Galilee region. Messengers from a centurion? Where have I seen that before? That memory should have triggered Peter's acknowledgement of Yeshua's willingness to enter the house of the first centurion. This is why we see the Spirit prompt Peter to action in Acts chapter 10, verse 20. Rise and go down and accompany them without hesitation, for I have sent them. But now we know what type of mindset Peter undoubtedly had when he went with these men up to Caesarea. This is why he said in Acts chapter 10, verse 28, you yourselves know how unlawful it is for a Jew to associate with or to visit anyone of another nation, but Elohim has shown me that I should not call any person common or unclean. And it's with that statement that we can finally approach Acts chapter 15 with the proper perspective. So now that we've looked at the events from Acts chapter 13 and 14, where Paul and Barnabas began bringing the gospel message to the Gentiles and including them into the faith, We've looked at Peter's vision in Acts chapters 10 and 11, and we've examined the link between that event and what took place in the Gospels immediately after the Sermon on the Mount. Now we're in a good frame of mind to examine the issues that arise in the church at Jerusalem in Acts chapter 15. So to understand Acts chapter 15, we must first look at the last few verses of chapter 14 once again. As we examined chapter 14 in our last episode, we saw that this chapter ends with Paul and Barnabas leaving Lystra, where Paul had been stoned, and they made their way, eventually, back to Antioch after visiting several other communities along the way. Acts chapter 14 ends this way, "And when they arrived and gathered the church together, they declared all that Elohim had done with them, and how he had opened a door of faith to the Gentiles, and they remained no little time with the disciples." That's where chapter 14 ends, but the story continues. Some of us may mistakenly assume that the entirety of Acts chapter 15 takes place in Jerusalem, but that's not the case. The first two verses of Acts chapter 15 take place in Antioch. In verse 4, Paul and Barnabas arrive in Jerusalem, and the conversation about what took place during their travels is what prompts the discussion that we will look at through the remainder of Acts chapter 15. But first, let's take a look at the source of contention, which is laid out for us in the first two verses. Verses 1 and 2 say, "But some men came down from Judea and were teaching the brothers, 'Unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moshe, you cannot be saved.' And after Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and debate with them, Paul and Barnabas and some of the others were appointed to go up to Jerusalem to the apostles and the elders about this question." So let's look at this point by point. The first thing we see here is that men traveled to Antioch from Judea. For what reason would these men leave Israel and journey to the church that Paul and Barnabas were teaching at? Did the congregation in Antioch need more teachers? Were Paul and Barnabas not enough? Or did they go there specifically to challenge Paul and Barnabas? We're not given the reasons, nor are we given the motives of these men. We simply see that they went from Judea to Antioch. Now, the distance from Jerusalem to Antioch is over 700 miles. That's a journey that would have been roughly 4 weeks of travel on foot, or about 18 days on horse, or about a week and a half if traveling by boat. Now, I say all this to illustrate the determination with which these men must have made their plans to journey to Antioch. This wasn't just a, "Hey, we're in the neighborhood and we thought we'd drop by" kind of moment. This was an intentional visit. Again, we aren't told exactly why they came, but we should be mindful that this was a trip that required planning and forethought. With that in mind, what do these men do when they arrive at the church in Antioch? They were teaching the brothers, "Unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moshe, you cannot be saved." Huh? In order to become saved, all one needs to do is to get circumcised? So are the non-Israeli cultures that also practice circumcision, are they saved already? Muslims practice circumcision. I mean, they're descendants of Abraham too. In fact, there were many cultures, including the Egyptians, who practiced circumcision before Abraham was commanded to do so. So, does that mean that they're saved? Is circumcision equivalent to salvation? No. Not even close. Circumcision is nothing more than a sign. Genesis chapter 17, verses 9 through 14 describes the instructions that Adonai gave to Abraham concerning circumcision. Physical circumcision in the flesh was a physical sign of being in covenant with Adonai according to this passage. Additionally, a point we will look at in just a minute is that physical circumcision is also a physical application of the instruction concerning having a circumcised heart. But circumcision in the flesh of a man's organ serve simply as a sign he will see on a regular basis. This sign, visible on the most sensitive part of his body, the organ that's tied to reproduction, to being fruitful and multiplying, is a reminder to the man every time he sees it that he is in covenant with the one who gave him the ability to reproduce. Let me put it to you this way. I wear a wedding band. This wedding ring is a sign that I'm married to my wife, just like circumcision is a sign of our covenant with Adonai. If I remove my wedding ring, does that mean that I'm no longer married to my wife? Not at all. If another man wears a ring, does that mean that he's married to my wife? Of course not. Anyone can get a ring. Just because someone wears a ring doesn't mean that they're married or in covenant with someone. My daughters wear rings, but they certainly aren't married. This ring that I wear is a reminder to myself of my commitment to my wife. It's also a sign to others that I'm married to my wife. In the same way, circumcision is a reminder to myself that I'm in covenant with Adonai. Unlike my wedding band, however, circumcision is not a sign to others of my covenant status. This is exactly why the first verse in Acts chapter 15 is so odd. It should be irrelevant to these men from Judea whether or not the new believers were circumcised. Is circumcision a necessary requirement for salvation? No. This is exactly the message of Romans chapter 4. Let's take a look at that passage. Beginning in verse 7, it says, "Blessed are those whose lawless deeds are forgiven and whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man against whom Adonai will not count his sin." Is this blessing then only for the circumcised or also for the uncircumcised? For we say that faith was counted to Avram as righteousness. How then was it counted to him? Was it before or after he had been circumcised? It was not after, but before he was circumcised. He received the sign of circumcision as a seal of the righteousness that he had by faith while he was still uncircumcised. The purpose was to make him the father of all who believed without being circumcised, so that righteousness would be counted to them as well, and to make him the father of the circumcised who are not merely circumcised, but who also walk in the footsteps of the faith that our father Abraham had before he was circumcised. So, looking at these words of Paul from Romans chapter 4, where he cites from Genesis chapter 12, Genesis chapter 15, and Genesis chapter 17, we can easily refute the ideology of the men from Judea who expressed in Acts chapter 15 that these Gentiles needed to be circumcised in order to be saved. In Genesis chapter 12, Adonai calls Abraham to leave Haran and to go settle in the land of Canaan. By faith, he obeys. Then in Genesis chapter 15, Adonai appears to Abraham and promises him a son. Verse 6 says, "And he believed Adonai, and he counted it to him as righteousness." Then, in chapter 17, Adonai appears to Abraham again, after his son Ishmael is born, but before his son Yitzhak is born. And it's in chapter 17 that Adonai instructs Abraham to circumcise himself and his household. So we see by the very example of the man with whom Adonai established the covenant of circumcision that his faith came before the sign of circumcision. His belief was credited to him as righteousness before he received the sign of the covenant in his flesh. So then, we must ask the logical question. If Abraham had died before he was circumcised, would he have been considered saved? Additionally, if we skip ahead to Genesis chapter 34, we see the story of Yaakov's return to the land of Israel after spending 20-some years in Haran with his uncle's family. When they arrive at Shechem, Yaakov's daughter Dinah is violated by the prince of Shechem. Dinah's brothers then devise a plan to exact revenge on behalf of their sister's honor. They convince the men of Shechem to circumcise themselves under the guise of joining their clan. So, were the men of Shechem saved then, once they were circumcised? If we're being consistent with the sentiment expressed by the men from Judea in Acts chapter 15, verse 1, we'd be forced to assert that these men were indeed saved by this act of circumcision. Yet there is zero indication that they ever swore fealty to Adonai, submitted themselves to his will, or even believed in him. So what are we to say then about circumcision? Is it for salvation? Of course not. It's a sign, an outward physical sign that is to reflect an inward change, one that we'll discuss in a future episode. So what then is the purpose of circumcision? It is to establish something as being devoted to Adonai. We can see that point established from several passages in the Torah. We know from Genesis chapter 17, where circumcision is established as a sign for Abraham and his household, that it is a sign of the covenant between Adonai and Abraham, and that Adonai tells Abraham, "So shall my covenant be in your flesh as an everlasting covenant." But verse 14 presents an interesting conundrum for us. It says there, "Va'arel, any circumcised male who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin shall be unikrata, cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant." Now, I've highlighted two Hebrew words here in that passage intentionally. The first word, va'arel, we'll discuss in a moment. First, the second word that I pointed out, unikrata. This is the word karet, which we discussed at length in the series on Shabbat, which are episodes 13 through 18, if you want to go back and watch those. In those episodes, we discussed how the word karet can mean either to excommunicate someone, or it could be interpreted to mean to kill someone. Not to murder someone, but to put someone on trial, and if found guilty, to sentence them to the death penalty. So we can see from Genesis 17, verse 14, that Adonai considers circumcision to be a pretty serious topic. And yet, we will see in our next episode, when we examine the words of the prophets Jeremiah and Ezekiel and what they have to say about this topic, thematically speaking, that physical circumcision isn't the real issue. The real issue goes much deeper than simply a mark in the flesh. That brings us back to the first word that I highlighted, arel. This word is used 35 times in the Tanakh, and overwhelmingly, it's translated as uncircumcised. It's normally presented as something that is negative or something that's to be avoided. The first time it appears in Scripture is in the verse that we just read from, Genesis chapter 17, verse 14, where it's presented as something that's definitely negative. If someone is arel, uncircumcised, they're to be karet, cut off. But this word arel is not used exclusively to refer to physical circumcision in the male organ. For instance, the next time it's used in the Scriptures, Moshe says this in Exodus chapter 6, verse 12. "Behold, the people of Israel have not listened to me. How then shall Pharaoh listen to me? For I am arel shifatim, of uncircumcised lips." What an interesting phrase. He repeats this phrase in verse 30. Was Moshe saying that he needed to shave off some of his lips before Pharaoh would be willing to hear him? Of course not. Further, we see this in Leviticus chapter 19, verse 23, where it says, "When you come into the land and plant any kind of tree for food, then you shall regard its fruit as va'aral tem, forbidden. 3 years it shall be arelim, forbidden to you. It must not be eaten." So in this passage from Leviticus, Adonai describes the fruit of trees that hadn't yet reached their fourth year of life to be arel, uncircumcised. Then in the next verse, it says that in the fourth year, all its fruit shall be kodesh, holy, an offering of praise to Adonai. This communicates to us a very important principle that we need to pay very close attention to. You see, in the first 3 years of the life of a fruit tree that's planted in the land of Israel, its fruit is considered to be arel, uncircumcised, and we are explicitly instructed not to consume that fruit. But then there's a shift, a change in status in the fourth year. Does something magical happen between the third and the fourth years within this tree that would then result in it making the fruit somehow change from uncircumcised to holy? No. The key is in understanding that in the fourth year, the fruit is devoted to Adonai. In essence, the transformation that causes a change in the status of the fruit from the tree is that the fruit is devoted to Adonai. This makes the fruit holy. Once the fourth year fruit has been completely devoted to Adonai, then in the fifth year, the fruit can be consumed. This passage helps us to gain some perspective on the difference between something that is considered arel, uncircumcised, and something that is considered kodesh, holy. It has to do with being devoted to Adonai. The distinction that's being made here in this passage from Leviticus establishes that circumcision, or more literally, a lack of uncircumcision, is a status that communicates devotion to Adonai. I mean, this actually makes a lot of sense. Here's Avraham, devoted to Adonai, willing to leave behind everything that he knows in order to follow the instruction of the Lord. His faith was demonstrated through his obedience. And then he's told to circumcise himself and his household. Now, his household was composed of a bunch of grown men, not 8-day-old babies who could cry and be held and comforted by their mother. These were men who would have had to suffer through the post-op recovery without the use of modern medicine, painkillers, or anything like that. Plus, time marches on despite what we may wish. These men who were a part of Avraham's household still had duties and responsibilities that had to be tended to. Animals would still need to be fed and cared for, and other household chores. It was up to these men to see that those things still happened, all while attempting to recover from having their most sensitive organs surgically altered. That requires devotion to the one who gave his instruction to circumcise themselves. If the men of Avraham's household were not devoted to Adonai in the same way that Avraham was, can you imagine how much of a protest they might put up to becoming circumcised? How much complaining they may have done while recovering? Yet, there's no mention of any type of that behavior. Submitting to the instruction concerning circumcision displays devotion to Adonai. This is why it's called a sign, not a sign that other people will see, like my ring, because men don't exactly go around dropping trow and showing off their sign of the covenant. This sign, however, is on the most private part of their body. Instead, circumcision is considered a sign because it demonstrates a willingness to become obedient even when it hurts. It's a sign of devotion to Adonai, just as the fruit in the fourth year is devoted to him. So we could then conclude that circumcision is more about a demonstration of submitting one's will to Adonai than it is about making a mark in one's flesh. That being the case, we've now laid the groundwork for understanding the point of circumcision, which will help us to understand the function of what circumcision accomplishes. That will lead us to understanding the circumstances that arise in Acts chapter 15. But to get to that point, you'll have to wait until our next episode. Until then, shalom. We'll be right back.
Thank you.